I'd like to thank everyone for coming. For people who do nocturnal research this ungodly early hour of the day. And I'd also, before we get started, I'd like to thank Don Weber for co-organizing this with me, which in this case really means he did all the work. And I put it into the computer, so I got to be first author. Today, I'd kind of like, before we get started on my talk, I'd like to dedicate, and my talk at least, to two people. One, Will Whitcomb, who in many ways pioneered a lot of the work that's been done on predators back when it was tough, and was a wonderful man, and definitely was the first one that I'm aware of that tried to look at predation both during the day and during the night. The other person I'd like to dedicate this, and it's a shame he couldn't be here, or didn't want to be here this year, is Ken Yergin. And I was a student of Ken's, and he recognized how important nocturnal predation was and started to work on it. And that idea felt blossomed, let's say, very much in this student who found it much easier to stay up all night than to get up early in the morning, or even be on time early in the morning. So I really would like to dedicate this to them. I'm going to talk or begin the presentation on discovery of novel predators and predation patterns after dark. And I really want to stress the fact that there are novel predators. I mean, there are things that we just would not expect that are important. So it's not so much about patterns. We'll talk about that a little bit, but it's really about the predators. So now remember, when I started doing this work, it was 1993. So some of these earlier slides really reflect the situation then and what I was thinking at the time. So when we look at mortality of crop pests, certainly in row crops and annual crops, predation, often the most important mortality factor. In many cases, we can determine the impact of predators. However, it can be much more difficult to accurately identify the predators that are causing that mortality, and particularly nocturnal predation. So most of the work done before then, rather than actually going out at night and trying to be careful about that, essentially people would go out into the crop during the day and they would sample predators and they would essentially infer importance by abundance. Now, as far as I know, there are two studies really that tried to look at day and night predation before 1993. One of them by Vickerman and Sunderland, published in 78, which unfortunately I just very recently found out about, so I didn't know about this back then. They collected predators from cereal crops, and they did this at 3-hour intervals for 24 hours, and then they used a precipitant test to see which predators were feeding on aphids. And this was actually a very nice study, did a very wonderful job at looking at both day and night predators. But again, I didn't know that. Then there's the paper by Godfrey, Steinach, and Whitcomb, and this was in, Chris Godfrey was a student of Will Whitcomb's, where they tried to look at predation during the day and during the night in soybean. Now, this was a nice attempt, however, they had very low sample sizes. They spent relatively little time actually at night, probably 80% of their efforts were during the day. And then in the end, they just put all of their predators together, so we can't go in and really see what was going on day and night. But it was certainly a valuable attempt. Now, there were certainly other studies where they tried to identify predators, particularly with autoradiography and molecular techniques, and they all had major drawbacks. Now, these techniques have certainly improved a great deal since then, and certainly as John and some of our other speakers will discuss. But some of the problems, the sampling area, error. They were, essentially they would sample the insects during the day, so anything that wasn't in the foliage during the day would have been missed. Often a lot of the molecular markers had variable effective time frames, so you might detect a marker for 10 hours, and thus your results were very dependent on when you took your samples. And often, at least with autoradiography, you could not separate interguild predation. So with that in mind, I wanted to try to get around a lot of those biases and quantify both diurnal and nocturnal predation, and simultaneously measure predation, identify the predators, and determine their diurnal period is. We had essentially no information on how predators might be active during the day and during the night. To do this, I was looking at predation on lepidopteran pests in row crops, particularly the egg stage. So the first couple years that I worked on this was in Kentucky as a student. You sentinel eggs, and we'd have a group of 10 HZA eggs on green florist paper at each site, 12 sites per plot, and this was in corn and soybean. Go out and do essentially run the trap line every 3 hours, observe the predation, and identify the predators. And in this case, whenever a predator ate any of the eggs, we would replace them so that the number of eggs were constant. This reduces our ability to measure predation, but makes it a little easier to identify predators. So the picture in the lower left of my field plots are 11 by 11 meters. The sentinel sites were two rows in each plot, about 1.5 meters apart. And you can, in the upper right in the soybean, you can see the red flags denoting the sites where I'd put the eggs. I'd put the eggs about 2/3 of the way up in plant canopy, place where you would normally find eggs of most of our lepidopteran pests at least. And then in the lower right, you can see example of the egg sheet that we used. Now, going into this study, we certainly had expectations of the predators we might find in these crops. Some of the heteropterans, nabids, geocoris, anthochorids, and coleomegalomaculata. We've seen all these predators active in our field, so we knew they'd be important, but we really had no a priori expectation of what we might find at night. Or at least I didn't. Ken Juergen might have, but I didn't. So, you know, these are the ones we might have expected to see. And when I went out in the fields, essentially, I would just move down the row quickly, observe each sheet, and see if something was actively feeding. If there was a predator on the sheet, if it was not feeding, I wouldn't record it. It had to be actively feeding. Now, at night, I just used a white light. It turns out that that doesn't seem to bother predators. Most of them, if they're feeding, they'll continue to feed. I actually had more problems during the day with some of the predators with good vision, where you really had to look ahead, for example, for geocoris, because it would see you coming and zip over to the bottom of the leaf if you weren't careful. And then I'd count the eggs and collect any predators that I couldn't identify. So if we look at the patterns of predation, now this is through the day and night, and going from 9 a.m. on the left to 6 a.m. on the far right within each pair of columns, and that's for soybean on the left and in corn, and going through the season as we go from top to bottom, predation typically increased, and we can see that in most sampling periods we tended to have a peak during the day and a peak during the night. And that, not every time, but that was fairly common, and that's something that I've seen in other crops and in other years as well. Now, during the day, we did indeed see all of the predators that we expected to see. You know, here's an example of coleomegalo larvae feeding on eggs. But then at night, we saw a number of predators that we just completely did not expect. I would never have expected phalangids moving up into the soybean foliage and feeding on corn earworm eggs. Never would have expected it. We also saw a fair number of small spiders, Eclubiana abidi. I never would have expected it. And we also saw lots of nabids at night. Now, the one publication that did try to look at the activity patterns of nabids in Kentucky had shown that they tend to be more active early in the morning and late in the evening. It turns out that wasn't quite right. So if we look at the actual activity of each of the predators that we found, or at least the more common ones, we can see, and again, this is day and night for soybean on the left, corn on the right, across the top are the nabids, and we can see that they are primarily nocturnal and also much more common in the soybean, or much more important in the soybean. Coleomegalla, primarily day active, although one of our later speakers later found out that it turns out that the adults are primarily active during the day and the larvae are active both day and night. And they were the dominant one in the corn. And then as we move down for aureus and the phalangids and on, they tend to be active during the day or during the night. We don't have a lot of mixing. Now, I had mentioned that all the data we had at the time showed the nabids as being more active early in the morning and late in the evening. And here, if we break it down, you can see both for adults and nymphs, far more active at night. And nymphs tended to be active early in the evening, and adults kind of later towards morning. So not only do we have patterns between day and night, we also can have variation between stage and variation within a diurnal period, whether it be day or night. So from the work in Kentucky, made some conclusions. Okay, certainly plenty of surprises in the nocturnal predators, things we just would not have expected. And as many of you who know me, and this is something that I've kind of preached over the years, is if we're not going out at night, we really don't know what's going on. Predator taxa tend to be day or night active, not both. And that peaks in the diurnal patterns of predation tend to be driven by individual predators. So if there's a peak in the day of when predation is high, there is going to be a particular predator that is driving that mortality. So in my opinion, understanding the activity patterns of the predators is critical. We can measure predation, but we have to go back and look at the individual predators that are causing the mortality and what their activity period is. And this is particularly important if we're going to design techniques to actually try to separate how these predators are impacting specific pests. Now, an additional observation, and I alluded to this earlier, was that if we look at predator abundance during the day, we could be missing things. And that there might be differences between the activity pattern that we observe and their presence in the foliage. So I have some data on this in Texas. Now, we predator on the left, and this is just density per row meter in soybean. This was a sample date in 2002 in July. And so if we look at Geocris punctipes, we can see that the densities are almost the same in day or night, but it's a day active predator. So it's still in the foliage, but it's just not foraging. If we look at the nabids, kind of a similar situation, that the densities are the same day and night, but it's actually not nocturnally active. Now, if we go on further, we have things like earwigs, where we don't find any during the day because they're down hiding in the ground in the leaf litter. But if you have earwigs in your crop, they can certainly be causing a lot of mortality at night and when they move up into the plant. So now, after a stint as a postdoc, I moved to Texas and was fortuitously assigned lepidopteran pests, particularly bee armyworms, but I thought I would work on parasitoids. But I could go out in the cotton fields, and we had wonderful trap catch. I mean, we catch thousands of bee armyworms, but I couldn't find a larva to collect a parasitoid from. So I started putting out sentinels, and at one point put out 3,600 hatching eggs, and within 6 days only recovered 7 larvae. So it was obvious that predation was, again, the dominant cause of mortality in the system, so decided to move on and using the same techniques as in Kentucky, look at predation. So similar techniques, one or two minor changes. The density of eggs per site varied a lot because I was doing a couple of different projects. And in this case, I did replace the eggs only when all of the eggs were consumed so I could get a better evaluation of both 3-hour predation and 24-hour predation. Here's my cotton field, and you can see the flags moving down. The white flags would denote cornea worm, and the orange flags would be the bee armyworm egg masses. Now, we would count all the bee armyworm eggs before we put them out in the field, and we would only evaluate predation of them at 24 hours because it was impossible for me to actually tell how many eggs might have been eaten if the egg mass was partially consumed. Now, we had the same, you know, cast of enemies that we might have expected to see. Certainly all of them had been documented in South Texas. We did add the spiders, but I figured that it might be a small component, kind of like Kentucky. Now when we go out, we evaluate predation. Predation was very high. Did vary some from year to year, but at least in this year, it tended to be around 70% every 24 hours. If we look at predation during the day and during the night, and rather than do it by 3-hour period here, I just compared day and night. You see in 2002, actually it was very similar, day and night, in all three crops. However, in 2003, we had much higher predation at night in cotton. And this is actually the more typical system or a situation in cotton where we tend to have much higher predation at night. Now, if you look at actually the number of observations of predation that we saw, that actually matches very well with predation. So we saw very similar levels of predation in soybean and corn and similar numbers of observations day and night. But in cotton, quite a different situation. Now, if we want to look at the predators that were causing this mortality, we can see that these predators, now these were all small plots, very directly adjacent to each other, and we can see that the predator complexes that were important varied across the crops, even though they were directly adjacent. So in corn, primarily fire ants, but then also Coleomagilla and aureus. Spiders, a small component. Soybean geocaris was our dominant predator. Spiders, a little more important. Coleops beetles, and then the fire ants were a little less important. And then if we go over to the cotton, we could some of the same predators. Spiders were our number one predator, followed by the fire ants. This is the cotton flea hopper. It's also a pest. It's a myriad. And then mites, and then geocaris at the bottom. Now, if we move on from here and we actually overlay which ones of these are day active and night active, and the nocturnally active ones are in orange, we can see in corn and soybean we have kind of a nice split between day active and nocturnally active predators. However, in cotton, our top four are all nocturnal, and this matches up well with the pattern of predation that we see. We see high predation at night. It's driven by nocturnally active predators. So one of our big surprises here is, unlike Kentucky, where the spiders were a surprise, but it was a relatively small component in the total predation, in South Texas, the spiders really, at least in 2001 to 2004, drove the system. They were consistently the top or tied for the top predator. And this is a chiracanthium. It's a common spider throughout much of the U.S. Now, interestingly enough, in the work in Kentucky, we found that most of the predators were either day active or night active, but not really both. Now here we see a little more gray area. And if we actually look at the predators we see during the day versus night, again with the overlay of orange being nocturnally active, we see that even some of our more important predators during the day were primarily nocturnally active. And that's partially a reflection of much lower number of predation events during the day. We can look in that kind of a geometric sense where the burgundy are nocturnal observations of predation, the blue is daytime observations of predation, and you can just see how the predation is completely dominated by those top four nocturnal predators. Now if we go in and look at the activity patterns, like I said, we did see a little gray area. Now here, this is a geocaris, we have both Levitopennis and Punctipes, primarily day active and primarily afternoon active. We rarely see them actually at the 9 a.m. sampling period. Now here's one of the ones where we see a bit of a gray area. This is the cotton flea hopper. Again, it's a myriad. And although it is primarily active at night, it will come out during the day quite a bit and feed. And we see something kind of interesting here in that the blue, which is the adults, they're actually active primarily before and after dusk, where the nymphs are much more distinctly nocturnal. So we do have to, you know, we can find quite a bit of differences between stages. And then, of course, we had this group of spiders, primarily in the Anaphenidae, Metergidae, and Clubionidae. This is our primary spider predators, Hibana futilis. It's an anaphenid. And this one we can actually see is, you know, definitely nocturnally active, and primarily early in the evening as well. Most of the spiders were active primarily between 9 and midnight. We did have a linophiid that came in after 3 a.m. and it tended to have a different activity period. So to summarize the observations in Texas and in those crops, okay, in this particular region, our nocturnal observations were either similar in level, you know, both mortality and number of observations of predation in corn or soybean, or higher at night, which in case was cotton. Again, our nocturnal taxa, most of them not likely to be represented in evaluations conducted during the day, and the activity patterns of individual predators did tend to drive the system. So again, nocturnal activity must be considered when we're evaluating predation. And we never expected the spiders to be dominant. So when you definitely start working at night, expect the unexpected. Again, we see many novel things. So I had done this work for about 4 years, and one of the interesting things is we did see a fair amount of variation from year to year in some of the predator taxa. So there are virtually no long-term data sets on predator activity. You know, there may be some on abundance, but very little on predator impact and activity in any crop system that I'm aware of. So I wanted to start developing a long-term data set, let's say 10 years plus, in cotton and soybean. Now, unfortunately, the cotton's been interrupted by the boll weevil eradication program and, you know, 8-10 sprays a year, but the soybean I've been able to continue this with. And again, expect the unexpected. So in 2006, historically, in the previous years, predation had been fairly similar day and night. And then coming in, and that was the case in the beginning of the year. But then come July, we had a massive shift. And all of a sudden, most of the predation was occurring at night. In this case, over 60% predation between dusk and dawn. Now, if we look at the arthropods observed feeding in the soybeans, now this is a summary of the 2001 to 2005 data, and it's in soybean it was more consistent than cotton, so this is fairly consistent from year to year. Geocaris is our dominant predator, then followed by spiders and call-ups beetles, and then there was a new predator. And some of you certainly know where I'm going with this. And I had only had one observation of this before 2006. And it turns out that this predator is an exotic cockroach, the Asian cockroach. First gotten into Texas, or at least into South Texas, the winter of 2005-2006. And this is when first I had no idea what it was, and then couldn't believe that German cockroaches had invaded my soybean field. Turns out that it's Platella cyanide. And in 2006, 37% of my predation events were caused by this cockroach, and it was driving that increase in predation to 65% at night. But whenever we see something new, we always wonder, okay, is this just something unusual? I mean, is something weird happened? We see it once, and then we're not going to see it again. And then it turns out, oops, how do we go back? Okay. That was my concern, but then this year, essentially, we see the same thing. And even with a very poor stand, poor canopy closure, situation, you know, very hot, drought, a situation I would figure would be anathema to cockroaches. We had very high densities of cockroaches. And this year, 41% of my predation events that I observed were because of this cockroach. And you can see some of the day active predators actually seem to be falling out of the system. And I don't know if there's any relationship here. I'm certainly not saying that there is. But Geocaris and the call-ups beetles definitely had seemed to disappear. Now, if we go back to earlier, and I showed at least the top part of this about the predators we see, are they actually in the foliage during the day and the night? If we sample them during the day, will we actually find them? And the cockroaches are kind of like the earwigs, where during the day we see very few. They're all down in the cracks of the soil or underneath dead leaves. But then at night, they, in very large numbers, move up into the foliage, at least in soybeans. And I'm sure when they stop spraying my cotton that there'll be large numbers in the cotton as well. They can reach extremely high densities. This is one of my egg sheets where they've consumed all the eggs and they're running around looking for more eggs. And they'll actually eat a good part of the sheet that had moth scales on it and accessory gland secretions because it at least smells like food. And this is an example of the kind of densities you can see at night. Now, if I had, like most of our studies, when we go out for 2 or 3 years, if I had stopped after 2003 or 2004, I would have, I would go along with just presuming that we'd have this similar system, but then we see this radical change, and I would never have seen it if I wasn't going out there at night. So I certainly encourage everyone who hasn't done so, please go out in your crops and check them out at night, and I'm sure This suggestion will be soundly encouraged by all of our other speakers today who will present many, many interesting things. So thank you very much.
Hey. A few minutes for questions, Bob.
Okay. Sure. Excuse me? He asked why we don't see much predation during the day in cotton. Again, I think it's driven to a large extent by the predators that are there. And particularly the spiders are mid to late season in very high abundance. And that and fire ants. So being primarily night active. We do see Geocaris and some of the other predators, but they just don't seem to cause much mortality of the eggs. Now, we also, these are complex systems, so we also have, thrips and other prey in there, so, they may be kind of, some of these predators might be spending more of their time foraging, let's say, in flowers for thrips. Certainly that would be the case with aureus.
Okay,
Sure.
Do you think you see the same pattern with other types of eggs, like deep-popper eggs or dead things that are embedded in the tissue?
I think you would see relatively less predation, but I would suspect that you would still see patterns driven by any particular predator that could consume them. So for example, with glass-winged sharpshooter eggs, we know that spiders will go through plant tissue to feed on them. So if we have if you have a system in grapes or in one of their alternate hosts where these spiders are common, and certainly the Hibana in South Texas would be, then yes, I would think you would see similar patterns. Now, I would think with any pest, you would see similar patterns, even if the predator complex is completely different. You're still going to be having day active predators and nocturnal predators. For example, the Asian cockroach, which I'm working on with some of my time, doesn't seem to feed on white flies particularly much, but it loves cotton aphids. So if we were to look at predators of the cotton aphid, then that cockroach would certainly go up. Or that cockroach would certainly be an important predator. Now among the spiders, one of the spiders that's common is an important predator of aphids. One of the spiders is not, because it just doesn't like to feed on them. So all of these details really will tell the story. Thanks, John.
I'm just wondering about if you saw any variation between like stages and nocturnal feeding, like for example, Coleomagella or larvae, would they feed later in the day and extend into nocturnal exhibition?
Definitely there can be stage specific differences in diurnal pattern of activity. Excuse me?
Have you observed any Coleoptera larvae at night, for example?
Oh, the Coleomagella, the larvae are active both day and night.
Okay.
The adults are primarily day active. I don't really see them at night. John?
When the cockroach came in, are you seeing a displacement of Geocorus predation? So you're seeing overall added?
Geocorus are still there. Now, I haven't gone back to actually look at my samples to look at if there's a population trend. So I don't know, but it's possible. Now the Coleops beetle had kind of disappeared from the system in about 2002 before the cockroach got there. And I think that, and maybe Coleomagella to some extent, might be related to fire ants coming in. Because we didn't have fire ants in extreme South Texas until the late 90s and around 2000. So again, complicated systems. I don't think the cockroach specifically, actually I take that back. I might have to see if they'll feed on Geocorus eggs, because Geocorus eggs would certainly be a very available food item for the cockroach. So it's possible. How are we doing, Don?
One more question.
Okay, Judy?
Is the feeding behavior of this Asian cockroach very different from other cockroaches that have been studied? Think of them as scavengers.
Well, I don't know that any other cockroaches have particularly been studied for predation, but I really don't know. I mean, that's, I don't know enough about the other cockroaches to comment. This one, I mean, relative to these egg sheets, we know that cockroaches are very responsive to volatiles. So I would suspect that, you know, they are also equally responsive. So that in that sense, cockroaches in general, you know, might forage and are opportunists, and they might forage in similar fashion, you know, relative to olfactory cues. But I'm arm waving, so I think we should move on to John.